Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And I'm Chris Tate from the Android Framework team.
Excellent. Chris, we've been trying to get Chris here for a while, and we just couldn't make the times mesh up because in the Bay Area, people are very personal and opinionated about their commutes because they're so incredibly horrible.
You must live close to the office.
I do not, but I take a bus that gets me here at the same time. That's the way I mitigate the horrors of the commute. But anyway, happy we could make this work.
Glad to be here.
Chris was on the framework team when I joined it almost 6 years ago.
Chris was on the framework team longer ago than that. Actually, I've been at Google almost 8 years.
Whoa.
My 8-year anniversary is coming up at the end of this month.
Were you working on 1.0?
I was working on before 1.0. So yes, I joined during the run-up to 1.0. So in that...
I picture it not as a run, but more like a zombie staggering slog.
Oh no, there was running. So yeah, I joined before the T-Mobile G1 shipped and have been working on the framework ever since then.
All right. So the framework at that time was basically everything... Most of the APIs that we offered, apart from like very domain-specific things like, you know, media and location APIs, it was sort of the system APIs and the visual APIs and everything below it, right?
But, right.
And everybody was in the same one framework team, and then over time that team grew, and then we started splitting, and now we sort of have these divisions of like, well, there's the visual stuff, which is the toolkit team, and then there's the non-visual stuff, which is the rest of framework.
Pretty much, yeah.
Essentially.
And you're right about the history. It was all, you know, one relatively small happy family at that time. And of course, as Android itself has grown and become much more prevalent and much more featureful, you know, you just need more people to work on everything and to make sure that all the bases are covered.
Small and happy, and now it's large and completely dysfunctional.
Oh, please.
So you're on the non-visual part.
I don't do pixels.
Okay.
I just don't. You really would not be happy if you put me to work on something that would wind up drawing on the screen. So Chet understands that, my boss understands that, and everybody stays happy.
Okay. So what have you been working on most recently?
Most recently really has been the coming to fruition of a long-term project, which is to get cloud-based backup of everything that you do with your phone. Now, even since 1.0, products like Gmail and Google Calendar and so on, which are fundamentally web apps where the data lives in the cloud, that's the origin and that's where all the bookkeeping already existed, those apps have had Android presence and you could read your mail on your phone. It would arrive at the server and so on. It was synced back and forth in real time. But there was never a good framework or platform for apps to use where the data didn't really live in the cloud. It was just, you know, whatever you happened to be doing on your phone, but you didn't want to lose it when you bought a new phone.
You're talking specifically about Candy Crush levels.
No, I'm not.
Oh.
Please.
Oh.
Well, no, just you know, your wallpaper image or how bright or how dark you want your screen or which font size you want to use on that particular device. Or, you know, things like that, the individual device customization that, you know, you don't want all of your different devices to necessarily look and act identical all the time. You know, maybe on your phone, you want to have one particular wallpaper image, and on the tablet that you leave at home, you want to have a different one. You know, those are not really good candidates for being synced in real time. And any time you make a change on one device, it shows up everywhere else. You know, people want the ability to customize individual devices, just like they want to be able to get at their data all the time from everywhere for those class of uses. So,
but that's specific to device settings. But there's the whole host of other things which came online more recently, which is more like what Tor was alluding to, which is the app data, right? The level that you're on in that specific game, or the you know, configuration that you've given in the settings of a particular app.
Maybe we should do this chronologically, because I remember, so you mentioned Gmail. I think I started using Android in the Gingerbread timeframe. And I remember I was very impressed that when I got a phone, it would install the apps I had. So we've for a long time have done a lot of cloud stuff, I think, like calendar appointments and things like that would sort of be in the cloud, right?
Yeah, and Play Store at that time, I think, too, synced apps to some degree.
Well, it doesn't sync them. This is actually a good use case. So you can think of which apps I have installed on my phone as being part of that individual device's configuration. You know, I want to have Candy Crush on this phone, but I don't want to have it on my work phone, even though I've told my work phone how to connect to my Gmail account during the day.
Right.
You know, you want the states to be different. You don't want, you know, if I install an app on my phone, I don't want to automatically install the same app everywhere. That's not something that people expect.
But we did do something like that, right? In the sense that if I got a new phone, it would start restoring stuff. I didn't have this phone. This is a new phone, but it's like, oh, let me put back whatever apps I'd installed, right? So there's some sort of knowledge of things associated with my account.
The way that works is the Android backup mechanism.
Oh, nice segue.
Right, what's that?
Okay, so.
What's that? So starting in Eclair for built-in applications and in Froyo, was that Android 2.2, I think?
8.
Before my time.
API level 8, that's all I know.
Okay. I think that was API, or Android
Froyo was 8.
2.2, yeah. API level 8 was Froyo. That's when it went to be public API that any application could take advantage of. Android introduced this mechanism so that an app could back up designated data. Google would take care of storing it in the cloud. And then when you got a new phone and you set that up and you said, you know, this is the user whose phone this was, it would reach back and say, well, okay, you had a phone that you've been using until recently, and I will just give you back all of the data, all of the configuration that I can from that phone. Play Store was one of the apps that was participating in this mechanism from day one. And in their case, their saved state let them figure out, okay, so your previous phone had this selection of applications on it. So I will now just automatically push those exact applications to your new phone, and it will be as though nothing had changed. And this is wonderful and awesome, and everybody loves it. I'm glad you brought it up. It's one of the most visible successes of the whole idea of this is why we do backup and restore on Android.
So that's at the app level, or just to be confusing, it's sort of at the apps app level. Because at the end of the day, Play Store is just an app. It just happens to manage apps.
Exactly.
But then there's the device setting aspect that you were talking about before. Did that also come online at the same time, or was that prior?
It all uses the same mechanism. You can think of the Android OS itself as being one particular quote-unquote application on the phone.
Mind blown.
You know, technically it has a package name that is unique to the Android OS, and the package is the fundamental piece of bookkeeping about, you know, this app versus that app.
What is the package name for Android itself?
It's just Android.
Okay.
It's the only one that's allowed to have a package name that doesn't have dots in it and look like a domain name.
Okay.
It's special.
Yeah.
Okay, so the system itself, or the Android-named application, would manage device settings like, you know, the brightness of the screen.
Brightness
example.
Of the screen.
Wi-Fi settings, I think, was part of this.
Wi-Fi
well.
Access point definitions that the device knows about, you know, so that you don't have to enter your home Wi-Fi password again on your new phone every time you upgrade.
Yep.
Your wallpaper image, which is a system global thing that gets stored there.
Okay.
Stuff like that.
Wait. The wallpaper, like the actual image?
The actual image.
Oh, interesting.
So that also came online in the same release, or did it use an internal version and then we had public API eventually?
Technically, in Eclair, it came online and it was system internal only, mm-hmm. so that only these, you know, sort of built-in and right. system-aware applications could take advantage of it. The same API, literally the same API, is what went public in Froyo after it shook out for a release and we said, yes, this works.
Right.
We'll ship it in Froyo.
Which is, I should point out, that's the way a lot of the framework or the system overall, or probably a lot of systems evolve, is you implement functionality and you basically dog food it internally. You use it internally and sort of work out the kinks, but don't necessarily expose the API at that time. Not because you're cruel, but because it'd sure be nice to know whether that's the API you want to live with forever.
Absolutely. And that's been an Android sort of development principle since before 1.0. A lot of the Android API is the way it is because prior to 1.0, people had to do things like write a Gmail application, write an alarm clock application, and they discovered what worked and what didn't work about the APIs that they thought they were going to use. And there was a lot of churn in the early days trying to figure out what was a good model that was flexible enough and functional enough and so on. So really, the idea of try out the API, design something you think will work, write some real code with it, see if you're right. If not, you go back to the drawing board and you don't actually ship it until you're happy with how that process worked. That's been a guiding principle really for a long time.
Sorry, so I interrupted you mid-thought about, okay, so the system was using it internally in Eclair.
In Eclair.
And then in Froyo, you basically unhid the APIs that we were using.
Exactly.
Made those public.
Now, at that time, the API that we could ship in whatever year that was, 2010, 2000, yeah, 2010, I think, you know, LTE didn't exist yet. 3G data was pretty much everywhere in the United States and pretty much not anywhere in places like Indonesia or other places that simply did not have really large-scale developed cellular network infrastructure yet. They were moving very rapidly on it. It wasn't there yet. But we couldn't assume that we had lots of data bandwidth to play with. We couldn't assume that people necessarily had lots of cloud storage to play with. So the API at that time was designed to be very, very minimal on the wire, you know, not putting much data over the air at any one time. And there's a trade-off that gets made between the amount of data, you know, how conservative of bandwidth you are, and how involved the application has to be in terms of telling the system, I want you to back up exactly this data, but not that data, or telling the system, I have changed this small amount of data, so you should make an update just to that small delta from what was there before. We couldn't just say, okay, here is all of my data, store a copy of it to the cloud like you would if you just wanted to, you know, copy something off to another disk on your home computer.
So it was opt-in at a very granular level.
So it's opt-in, and the application developer has to write code to transmit the current, you know, the data that they want to save, and write the code to consume the data when it comes back at restore time, and write the code to track changes on an ongoing basis as the user goes and they, you know, use the application for a while and some of the data has changed and some of the data hasn't, to correctly and hopefully optimally store only what has changed as an update instead of rewriting the whole thing every time. So this is a lot of work in some cases. If you have a fairly sophisticated app that uses SQLite databases or things like that, it becomes pretty untenable to write that code. So adoption of this API was not very broad.
Right. So I remember that at the time that I thought it was really cool that Play Store would automatically update my new devices, and we change devices a lot around here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would automatically get all the apps showing up, but I wouldn't get any of the data associated with those apps. So it seemed to be an API that wasn't really picked up around some of the core infrastructure apps.
Right. And, you know, it's understandable because the API is kind of a lot of work to use. So...
And which API is it that we're talking about? Is it the backup agent?
Well, it's the original shipped in Froyo capability of the backup agent.
Okay.
So hold that thought, because the backup agent is still the interface point between an application and the whole backup and restore mechanism, but it has become more capable over time.
Okay.
In particular, in Marshmallow, we shipped a whole new suite of functionality also focused in the backup agent, where we can now do file-based backup and restore, and the app developer doesn't have to write any code.
I see. So how does that work?
The way that works is, well, if the app developer writes no code at all, they just say, you know, I am a Marshmallow application.
Target SDK version
target,
equals...
Exactly.
That's
23,
how you say
I think that
yeah.
is.
Okay.
Then the Android OS now says, great, I know what to do with that. And roughly once a day while the device is sitting on your charger overnight, connected to Wi-Fi. The OS will spin up your application and instantiate one of these backup agent components, call into it, and that agent will run through the entire file system of the application, you know, everything in the data directory, and say, okay, here, cloud, here's this file, here's this file, here's a shared preferences file, here's a database file, off you go. That's all my data. And the internal implementation of that says, great, okay, here I have this series of file data. It diffs that against what it sent last time. There's a rather clever binary diff engine sitting behind this, and then transmits that up to the cloud where it is stored in Google Drive.
Okay, so then it's less work for the developer because presumably they've already written the logic that deals with, you know, these files where they store the information, so they don't have to like create new data structures or parse special data that happens to be sent through this, you know, key mechanism that you had before.
Exactly.
And is the key point that if I'm on a new phone, we do some sort of restore then? We put the data back after we install it? Or how does this
work? Oh, yeah. So again, building on what already existed, if you happened to write an app that used the original, you know, key value based backup APIs, then what would happen when your app was installed is the OS would get to a certain point during app installation, check to see if there was data for that app that could be restored. If so, it would hold the install process and not complete it until it had delivered that data using that restore API, and then say, okay, now installation is finished and the user can actually start interacting with your app. So from the user's perspective, it all just happened as part of installation. And once the icon showed up in home, it was done. The data was there.
Right.
The same thing now happens when you have full file-based data. It's just that it's more data.
I see. So it takes all the binary diffs and applies them locally.
Well, for restore, there's no diff involved. It just has this archive, and it streams the archive back to the device and unrolls it onto the disk. You can think of it as being like a zip archive or a tarball or something like that full of file data.
I see. And that's because when you upload the diffs, it just applies those on the server. It doesn't store the diffs. It
exactly.
Keeps it.
Okay. Doesn't store the diffs. It just applies them to the archive as it exists, you know, essentially as one monolithic archive file in Drive.
I see. So you said this goes to Google Drive?
It is stored in Google Drive.
Is that sort of where all the backup data goes, or is that sort of specific to app data? Like, you know, like, is this data associated with your Google account then, and sort of treated like your Gmail data, or how? What's the level of service that you could expect for this kind of data?
It's all essentially treated like your Gmail data. You know, the data for your device is stored under one particular Google account, and you can go into settings and you can tell it which account to store the data under. And then as far as sort of level of service and so on, it uses the same Google backends that many other Google services use. So it's got all the same sort of support and ongoing load balancing and so on that Google brings to its regular server products. It's treated as user data. This is, you know, this is your personal information as far as we know. And so access to it is very tightly restricted, just like it is to your Google Calendar appointment lists and so on. Right. This is not something that random people can get access to.
I would hope not, because it would be embarrassing if people knew that on Flappy Bird, I never even got a single point. And
your secret
got
is safe with us.
All right. Yeah, this is just between us. So.
I think I got to 3 on, I know.
Show off.
Elite.
Actually, that reminds me. So I've noticed that a number of games now are using the Play Services Games. What is the product name of this? There's an official.
Play Games?
Yeah, is that what it's called? Okay. So they seem to have some sort of cloud support too, right? So you log in and then you sort of have shared levels for games that opted into that. That's, I assume, is a different?
It's a different mechanism and a different API. The explanation that I've heard in the past is that it's a little bit like those old-style PlayStation save game cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's a different model. It's one that was designed for the game kind of use case and for the way that people think about their gamed save state and so on.
Right.
It's not related to Android backup and restore per se. That's right. It's a Play Services API or Play Games API. That's a much more sort of Google-centric set of APIs, whereas the backup and restore mechanism is really part of the Android core platform API that any app can take advantage of.
Right.
Yeah, sort of the distinction. We had Jeff Hamilton on a while ago talking about Play Services and the distinction between the stuff that the platform does for anybody that adopts and ships the platform versus the stuff that's specifically Google services.
Right. So you mentioned that the default behavior for an app developer, if you're targeting M, Marshmallow, was to just basically go and take all files.
Back up the world!
Yes. I'm guessing there are probably ways to customize that, so where you don't back up stuff that really you think of as cache data or things that are really per session.
How perceptive of you. yes, exactly. There are various levels of involvement that an app can undertake to adjust what gets backed up and what doesn't get backed up. The sort of the first cut is that the platform intrinsically knows that, you know, things that are in the app's designated API-defined cache subdirectory, we're just not going to backup because those are probably things like your WebView image cache. We're not going to back that up. It's not expected to be durable even on your device. It's going to be huge. It's going to be irrelevant. Not a good idea.
Right. So it knows how to probably a good reason why developers should use the cache directory and not some other place.
Please use the cache directory. Do not just create random data directories full of spew. You are not doing anyone a favor.
Right.
Exactly. Beyond that, if, for example, you have some of your data in shared preferences that is really good to translate from device to device, but some of it which is not appropriate to move between devices, and I can give an example here in a minute.
I like how you build suspense.
Yes.
Dun, dun,
after
dun.
The break.
So at that level, you can write some XML in your manifest that says, I want you to back up this particular set of shared preferences and exclude this other set of shared preferences. There's a little bit of XML language that you can use to define things that should be taken, whole directories that should be taken, excluding individual files. Things like that. It's pretty flexible, goes a long way for almost every application because most apps tend to organize their data that way.
Right. So this is a file that describes what the file scanner should do, the one that by default will take all directories. It's sort of matching in this list to see.
Exactly.
Includes and excludes. And it's a separate file that I think you then reference in the manifest.
It's an XML resource that you build into your app that is then referenced from the manifest. There's an entry in the manifest that says, you know, the content description for my full backup is this XML resource over here, and off you go. Beyond that, for apps that want to get very detailed about what they back up and so on, you know, this is all API. There is a component called a backup agent, which is a component like an activity or a service. It's instantiated in the application. And the developer can choose to implement that themselves and do whatever they want to within the lifecycle of that agent. So, for example, there are a couple of components in the system that implement the agent, generate on the fly a file that is sort of a distillation of a bunch of little bits and pieces taken from multiple sources, backup that file. And then at restore time, they just pick it back apart and apply those little bits and pieces. It's because the data that they're working with does not translate really well to file-based backup and restore, but the flexibility is there so they can still participate in backup.
So there, when you were talking about what we had implemented in Eclair and exposed in Froyo, the main consideration was the constraint around bandwidth. Right, that people in these other places outside of Silicon Valley sort of didn't have access to the bandwidth that they would need to consume these, large amounts of data going back and forth for whatever game data. But now we are basically giving them what we couldn't at that time. Was this a sea change, or was this a recognition of, well, Wi-Fi is around, why don't we just use that as the mechanism?
It's a recognition of the way things are changing. 5, 6, 7 years ago, that was the way things were. But today, Wi-Fi is much more ubiquitous, especially in places like the U.S. and Europe. It's becoming far more prevalent, even in places that we don't think of as being early adopters of telecommunications technology. It's great. It makes all of this possible. We can now, start providing services that require a lot more bandwidth. Earlier, I mentioned that your device will sit there quietly, plugged into the charger, connected to Wi-Fi overnight, and back up all of this large file-based data. That is the constraint that it uses. It knows that it can't try to burn down your cellular data quota. It knows that it's going to be spending a while doing this, and it might use a lot of battery, so it requires charging. Especially now that the platform has other mechanisms to help apps find suitable times and suitable circumstances to do demanding work like this, the backup mechanism takes advantage of that to try to be as good a citizen as it can.
Are there ways, let's say I was the Google Photos app and I wanted the image backup thing that they have where photos are uploaded to the cloud, I don't actually know, but I'm guessing they want to maybe upload that faster than the next night you're plugged in, right? Because images are so precious, right? Compared to something like save state in a game. Or maybe that's precious to some people too. Are there ways to for an app, if they want to use this for the backup transaction, to trigger it and say, hey, this would be a really good time now. I've saved some stuff that I really think the user wants to have a transaction for.
So the application can't actually do that, and that's intentional because really we'd wind up in a situation where every app was trying to do that all of the time and you could kiss your battery goodbye.
Yeah.
The user, however, starting in an upcoming release, will be able to go into settings and say, I'm going to make sure that all of my data is up to date in the cloud, back up everything now that you think might need it because I'm about to go buy a new phone.
Yep.
And that is, that's really where we think that control should reside, is with the user, because they're the one who knows how much quota they have left on this. Because, if you do this in the middle of the day, you may not be on Wi-Fi, but if you're telling us to do that backup, we're going to do it, right? You care very deeply about that. So, okay, it's on your own head.
Right.
So I would assume, going back to your photos example, that app or apps like it would have their own internal mechanism to use something clever like the job scheduler and do it appropriately, but get it up there as soon as possible and then opt out of automatic data if they're storing it in a place where we're going to go ahead and update a second copy of it just through the default backup and restore mechanism.
Right. And the Photos app, as an example, does not use the Android backup and restore mechanism for that photo data.
Right.
They're using something that is more like a Gmail model, where it's a sort of a shared repository and you can view that data from any of your devices as though it were local. Honestly, that's a great model for many, many applications. And I would encourage developers to really think about whether that kind of cloud-based model is appropriate for them. It usually is. It makes for a great user experience. Backup and restore covers everything else.
Right. Makes
sense. I was thinking, so it's not so much the Photos app that would suffer from this duplication of data, because the Photos app is really a view, with metadata into what the camera on the device has taken. But you kind of want to prevent the camera from uploading all those device photos because there's already this other mechanism, right?
You should write an exclude then.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder.
So can you give some examples, actually, of some things that developers might want to remember when they write these backup descriptor files, some things that you probably want to exclude?
Well, if your application uses Google Cloud Messaging, then you absolutely must not back up the registration ID that your app got from the GCM mechanism. That ID is specifically tied to your app on that one device. And if you replicate that across multiple devices, then one of those devices, or maybe all but one of those devices, will stop getting any GCM messages at all because they're all claiming to be the same device for purposes of GCM. don't do that.
Yeah, that one I think we actually have a lint check for. So hopefully people using Android Studio will know.
Yeah, that's an example. You know, there's a lot of, you know, individual, you know, sort of unique ID kind of information that crops up not only with GCM, but other services have similar kinds of, you know, unique assigned ID. Same principle applies to them. You know, don't back up your WebView image caches. A lot of apps that have any kind of integral advertising or in-app purchase sort of history, those can tend to produce data on disk that is their own internal bookkeeping. You probably don't want to back that up. Things like that.
Right. Okay.
And this is default behavior on Marshmallow with target SDK check.
As long as your app targets API 23 or higher, which is Marshmallow or higher, that is, you know, sort of the sign that you, the developer, are working with the API set that defines all of this and gives you the tools to deal with it. We didn't think that it was really safe for the app to reach back in time and grab the data of apps that were already floating around with uncontrolled use of the data and no way for them to tell what to back up and what not to back up. It was really important that we be kind of hands off and have the developer make this explicit gesture of targeting the appropriate SDK level to say, yes, I know what I'm doing.
All right. So I think we kind of covered the backup and restore, but in the process of doing that, you alluded to job scheduler.
I did.
Which I would love to know more about. So we've talked about this in the past when it came out, and we've talked about what GCM Network Manager, I think, is sort of the Play Services equivalent of that that uses job scheduler underneath. We talked to the battery folks in our recent the power project, Volta, people about conserving power and using facilities like this. And apparently you work on this thing.
I do. I do. So I guess you've already covered a little bit about this, that in general, as Android devices and as phones particularly are just becoming much more capable and people are spending much more of their lives working through the phone rather than working through home computers that are plugged into the wall or things like that, just the ability to get that phone through an entire day without burning down its battery has become really important. They're doing more and more work. People are demanding more and more from them. And, you know, there's only so big that you can make the batteries, even with today's slightly larger phones. So we are hoping and attempting to provide tools to the application developers to be good citizens as far as the resources that their app uses. Job scheduler, the one we're talking about here, its purpose is for the app to be able to say, I have work that needs these kinds of facilities in order to proceed. You know, I need networking, or maybe I specifically need Wi-Fi that is not going to cost the user money. I know that my work is going to be pretty intrusive in terms of phone performance, and so I would prefer that it run when the user is not interacting with the device. That's a kind of capability you can express through the API. Tell me, operating system, when is a good time to do this work? So that, and I can just schedule the job, tell you what kind of work needs to be done, and let you figure out when it's going to happen.
And then when the system enters that state or some, you know, amount of time after it enters that state, it will then call you back. It'll launch an intent that is received by your application to wake up and do this thing.
Right. When you schedule a job, the way that your code expresses that job is as a service using pretty standard service lifecycle, just like we've had since 1.0. And when the system has satisfied all of your constraints, you know, when you need to run, whether you need the device to be idle, things like that, then it will bind to your service and start it running. There are callbacks that your job gets for when you start, when you stop. You know, if you say, I need connectivity, and you start work, and then the user goes into the subway and they lose their connectivity, the system will call into you and say, oh, by the way, you need to stop because you don't have network anymore. Things like that.
And then the key interesting piece with Job Scheduler is it's not just a callback mechanism, but it's a callback mechanism that is then pooled with other callbacks on the system, right? So it's not waking up for everybody that calls it and say, well, you know, we just got put on Wi-Fi, here you go. Instead, it is batching these things together so that the system doesn't have to keep waking up with every one of these single requests.
Right. And this is where the good citizenry really comes into play. You know, if you have 17 different apps on your device, all of which really want to do something once you get onto Wi-Fi, in the past, all of those apps would be monitoring your connectivity in real time. And when you connected to a Wi-Fi network, all of them would race to try to do their work immediately. And this is a terrible, terrible user experience because they'd all be competing.
They'd probably be thrashing each other out of the system.
Right. I mean, the system is not going to be able to fit all 17 of those apps in memory simultaneously. Yeah. So things would start getting pushed out, falling over, getting slow, backing off and having to retry and then compounding the problem. It just turns into a nightmare. If they all scheduled jobs using this mechanism instead, then the OS would run some appropriate number of them in parallel, depending on how capable the hardware was. You know, if you have a device that has a lot of memory, then maybe it can run a couple more of them in parallel than on a device that only has very restricted memory. But the OS is equipped to make those decisions in a really informed way that applications aren't.
Does it have heuristics for how it chooses who gets to go first?
It does. I don't remember the details of that over time. Those are things that we tune from release to release.
Right.
So it's not part of the API. It's just its internal heuristics.
Right. The API is intentionally designed to have the developer express what their job needs in terms of basic capability, like I need Wi-Fi, and not in terms of fine-grained, I really need to run at exactly this time, or I want you to run within thus and such amount of time of, you know, any of these very demanding kind of capability. It's not what it's for. It's for, tell me when to do this work that I have described. It's not for, I'm going to tell you when I need to do this work.
Right. And there's some built-in latency assumption in that, like, we're not going to call that service immediately upon entering those conditions. Instead, we want to batch things up and we want to wake up occasionally, because that was the whole point. Because every time the system wakes up and starts doing a bunch of work, then it has all these other repercussions on battery. So what we want to do is wait for, you know, N minutes, and then we've got enough batched up that we can do things, and then we're going to wait for, you know, N amount of time as well.
Right.
After that.
Right. In particular, one of the very powerful constraints that a scheduled job can say is, I want to do this work when the device is idle. Mm-hmm. Idle is one of those concepts that we keep tuning over time, but it basically means we're pretty sure that the user is not going to start touching the screen and playing Flappy Bird anytime really soon now. You know, it's been screen off, sitting quietly for some period of time now. It really looks like this is not interactive use going on. And so now we're going to step the device down in terms of battery use. We're going to kind of quietly stop running quite as much stuff in the background and give these particular scheduled jobs a chance to run, and then we'll let things go quiet again. This is part of battery conservation, is trying to be very conservative about work when appropriate, while trying to give the user full interactivity when they demand it. It's a tough balancing act.
It seems like a careful balance between this kind of facility and the doze mode that we've talked about, and there's new facilities in preview release, where if you're in doze mode, you're not waking up. You know, if the job scheduler wants to wake up at that point, they're not going to be able to. We're not executing background services when, you know, you are stationary on Wi-Fi charging, not being touched.
Right. Doze mode is something that kicks in when not only has the device been sitting quietly for a while, but it's also not charging. So we really we would be burning down battery if we did anything at all with this device. We kind of want to make sure that we don't do that in a way that is really destructive of battery. We want to try to optimize battery use.
I guess that's something I missed in the dose mode discussion then. So if my phone is plugged in,
it will never dose.
I see. So it'll make sure that when I turn it on, everything is fresh.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
Right.
That
yes.
seems like
but,
the right.
I mean, even in dose mode, it will wake up. I assume the job scheduler then has a chance to wake up in these periods, right?
Right. So I'm going to explain this a little bit. It's slightly non-intuitive. In dose mode, the job scheduler and the system in general, but the job scheduler tries to do lots of work in a short period of time when possible. And that sounds counterintuitive in a way, because wait a minute, why am I doing a lot of work when I'm trying to save battery? And the big reason for that is connectivity. So in particular, if you have jobs scheduled with the system that say, I'm going to be doing network access, tell me when is a good time to do that. One of the most battery draining things that you can do on a cellular device is go from not doing any data networking to starting to do networking. You know, the act of initiating data traffic is hugely battery impacting. Once you're started, then it's a lot less power to keep that going for a while. So if you have made the commitment to turn on those radios and start moving data, you want to pack as much data operation into the short period of time as you can to let that data radio power down into a standby state and stop using all that battery. The worst thing you can possibly do is to spin that data radio up, move a little bit of data, let it go back down to idle, and then spin it right back up again a short time later. So packing all of that into what are called these maintenance intervals while the device is in doze is one of the biggest battery optimizations that we've seen come along in Android recently.
Hmm. So I was curious about job scheduler changes in the preview release, which is out now. In particular, so there are some changes to background messages or actions that you cannot react to someone took a picture anymore, right? So the advice is to not use that old mechanism because this is really one of the battery killers. Someone who would take a picture and 80 apps would try to wake up and kill each other and thrash the device. And in fact, they didn't actually care. It's just that they, opted into this intent that went flying around the system or this message. And so now the advice is, okay, use job scheduler. But there are new facilities in Job Scheduler to allow you to do that more. Right.
Right. So, as you said, we're identifying more and more of these broadcasts about general system state that turn out to be pain points because lots of apps wind up receiving them, getting launched simultaneously, competing for memory, competing for network, interfering with the user's ability to interact with the app they actually want to be using, things like that. So we're trying to introduce new alternatives for apps to consume that kind of information in a less intrusive way. The new thing for Job Scheduler is now you'll be able to say, I have a job that defines some work that I want to do in response to this content provider over here having new data. So now it's like having, a content observer in your app, only it's a scheduled job so that when that content changes, that's the trigger for, now I know that this job will be running eventually at an appropriate time to handle that newly arrived data.
Okay. And are there standard content providers that are out there for these common cases where, I would like to do something when there is a new picture around?
For example, there's a new photograph. Okay. That would be the media provider because right. That's where photographs wind up.
And this already exists or is this also?
It's an existing provider.
Okay. Right. I think the new ones that I knew about are the changes were broadcast around picture and video. So I guess that would also be the media provider. And then there was also connectivity.
Connectivity changed. Fortunately, we already had job scheduler constraints where you could say my job needs connectivity or it needs free kind of, unmetered, which usually translates as Wi-Fi.
Okay. So we didn't need anything new there. We just need people to use the new mechanism.
Exactly.
So if you're in the background where you're not going to be getting that information. information.
Exactly.
Okay. And then something else you'd mentioned, I guess it relates to this whole thing, is also alarm scheduler, which really seems tricky, right? Scheduling alarms in a world where you don't necessarily want to wake up at a specific time or you don't want to wake up too often. So you worked on alarm scheduler.
Right.
What'd you do?
So, well, one thing we did is we wrote the job scheduler. So quite literally, you know, traditionally, applications that knew that they would want to do some work periodically in the background would schedule alarms that would go off whenever, and an app might be more or less clever about when it was deciding to kick off its work, and then it would do its work at that time and be done. That's not ideal. You know, the app doesn't necessarily have all the information that it needs to be a good citizen about when it's doing the work, competing with other applications. We've seen bugs in the field where apps across an entire device population wound up scheduling work at the same time of day, exactly the same time of day. And if they all tried to do networking at 7 o'clock in the morning, we heard about it actually from the cell phone carrier who came to us and they said, "We are seeing this huge network traffic spike from Android devices at 7 o'clock in the morning. This is not good for our network. What's going on?" So alarm, but, you know, time of day based scheduling of anything is a bad idea. It really is, unless you are writing something like an alarm clock that literally has to be about the time of day. Exactly. So we really want people, for the benefit of everything on the device and for the benefit of the user, to use things like the job scheduler, where the OS can do a better job of deciding appropriate time for the work, rather than the app thinking that it can decide exactly when the work should happen best. Because really, in practice, it just is fragile, and it doesn't play out very well across the device population or between applications on the same device.
And you know what? It all comes down to it's 5 o'clock somewhere. So just, you know.
Well, it's 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, this carrier that I mentioned, those were clearly the times of day when people's phones were ringing the alarm clock and they were getting up in the morning and checking their email or whatever. And at that time, network traffic was kicked off and it was so ubiquitous that they were seeing it as measurable and impactful load on their network.
Isn't it nice to
actually, even if you write an alarm clock, then you would help these networks if you made your alarm clock not very accurate so that people wake up at 6:55 and 7:05.
I think that you should focus on the user.
Yes.
Okay.
Probably a good idea.
So then alarm scheduler, I guess use job scheduler underneath to be able to batch these requests and do it at, you know, unspecified time, but within some window. I mean,
is alarm scheduler accurate? No,
there's alarm clock and alarm scheduler, and they're not the same thing.
Well,
alarm scheduler is
the alarm
accurate,
clock
right?
is an application. Then there's the alarm manager, which is the facility in the framework that you use to say, I want an alarm to go off at thus and such time.
Right. But that's an alarm. That's a callback that you want to go off at a certain time.
Yes.
Okay. Just to be clear, we're talking about facilities for waking up an activity to do something.
I just want to make sure I understood right, because something you said
was probably wrong.
Okay, well, you said that did you say alarm manager was sort of using job scheduler? Because I would think it'd be the other way. I would think that alarm manager has to be accurate, right? Because if you're going to run an alarm clock, that is how you do it, right? And so
exactly.
It better wake you up when you need to.
Yes. So internally, the job scheduler sets alarms when it has to, because it does need to know about things like deadlines and timeouts. And if an application has scheduled a job and said, I need this job to run, you know, whenever possible, but if it hasn't run within 4 hours, I need you to run it regardless. The job scheduler lets an application express that kind of semantic, and then it sets an alarm under the covers for that 4-hour timeout.
Okay. So then if people Our recommendation is for people to not use that kind of low-level facility saying, I want to wake up at this time, but instead back off and use the job scheduler and say, I'd like to do this thing.
Exactly.
At this point. Okay.
So, only use alarms for things where you know that that work has to happen at exactly that time regardless. This is relatively rare. Usually what you want to do is you want to have a chance to run sometime, and it doesn't matter exactly when it is. We want to encourage people to think in terms of the overall work to be done, not in terms of the scheduling.
But I guess it's important to note that, I mean, I could have gotten the impression earlier that job scheduler is going to try, but it may not guarantee it. But it sounds like you're saying that even if I have this thing that I need it to run within 30 minutes, it's better to use job scheduler because it will run it in 30 minutes with the alarm manager if it has to, but it could run sooner.
Yes,
someone
exactly.
Someone else requested it. So it's
the reason with the job scheduler that you would use a deadline like that where you say, I want it to run regardless, is maybe one of your constraints is something that you can't actually ever guarantee. Like, I need the phone to have connectivity. You know, if you're on an airplane, you're just not going to have connectivity while you're in airplane mode. So maybe those 4 hours go by and you want to be able to tell the user, you know, the time is up here and things are out of date, or, you know, depending on what your application is, there might be some reason why you set that 4 hour deadline. But it's there and, you know, just in case.
Right. So even if you have some sort of hard limit, you don't have to use an alarm manager. You can rely on job scheduler for this.
Yes.
But it's still better to use job scheduler because it could save battery by running sooner. If that
Absolutely.
Was okay. For the alarm clock scenario, you probably don't want to wake up in the middle of the night just because it's sooner.
No. And, you know, our alarm clock application and every other alarm clock application on Play Store just uses direct alarms.
And we encourage that.
Yes, please.
That's the only allowed use of alarm manager. Is that fair?
Well, probably if you have some sort of DVR application, you probably want that one to be accurate too.
There are reasons to use alarms when things happen is important. But much of the time, it turns out that just getting the work done is the important thing. When it happens, it's much less important. And
this sounds like an
cases,
engineering job description, actually. So,
well, it is
the
job
like your
scheduler.
Career. Yeah, there you go. All right. I think we're out of time. I don't know if there was anything else rather pithy and wise that you wanted to toss out there. What's your favorite API? Quick.
Favorite API. I actually rather like the job scheduler. It's still growing in capability, but just the ability to describe, you know, my app wants a chance to run and it needs these kind of system conditions to hold, like having connectivity, and let the OS try to do the best job it can of giving you an appropriate way to run that job. It turns out to be really beneficial. You know, battery is really expensive. That's why phones don't have enough of it. And phones are important, and running out of battery is a terrible, terrible thing.
All right, then. Job scheduler. Yay.
Yay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.